Will Gadd is an ice climber, a paraglider, and an all-round outdoor athlete, who was the National Geographic Adventurer of the Year and the UN Environment Mountain Hero. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Will Gadd. Will, thank you very much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
So you've done a lot of crazy achievements in your life, like the 24-hour climb, setting the world record for distance and paragliding twice, climbing Niagara Falls. But I want to know, how did you get started on this path? I mean, you grew up in the Canadian Rockies, right? Was that where your interest got started?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in outside of the Canadian Rockies in a town called Calgary and a city called Calgary, and then eventually moved up to Jasper and then lived in Colorado, but always in the Rocky Mountains, either in Canada or the U.S. And then for the past 20 years, I've been in Canmore, Alberta, back in the Rockies. But as a kid, I got out of the mountains a lot with my parents and other people. And then in high school, junior high school, got into it on my own. And I've just been out in the mountains a whole lot ever since.
But was there a point where you said to yourself that you were going to try to make like a career out of this? Because I had heard you were going to be like a lawyer at first.
I was on my way to being a lawyer. I was thinking I was going to be a North American Free Trade Agreement lawyer, a NAFTA lawyer.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the path. I was working for a judge, you know, I was doing all the LSAT thing, and that was the path. But I was working for this judge, and he said, you're argumentative enough and you're bright enough and understand things well enough to be a lawyer, but this outdoor thing is something you should really put more energy into. You really love that. See what you could do with that. He was saying he'd write me a recommendation. Very nice guy.
Yeah.
And I thank him to this day because he was right. I would have been an all right lawyer, but I've had a lot of fun doing what I've done the last 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think, though, that there might be some lawyer out there who could have been you. You know, there's plenty of people out there probably just haven't, you know, who are following that path, who just haven't stepped out of the bounds, which is why what you've done is so compelling. I wanted to ask, as a climber, I've been warned away from ice climbing by many people much more experienced than me. What is your approach to risk when choosing whether to make a climb?
Well, I think somebody's probably warning you away from ice climbing. Maybe they're warning you away because they have a realistic appreciation of its dangers, or maybe it's an unknown, and people right. are often afraid of the unknown for good reason. You know, the things that you don't know are the things that tend to get you. So I think my approach to risk has evolved a lot over the last, you know, 35 years of doing these sports, and I'm sure it'll evolve more. It's not a constant thing, and it's not, I don't have a system that says, yes, this is too risky, no, that's safe enough.
Right.
I don't have any like hard and fast answers on that. For me, it boils down to the basis of it all is that simplicity is a lot easier to deal with in a risky environment than complexity. So if you're just looking at things in terms of climbing, the, you know, a simple form of climbing, relatively speaking, is sport climbing. Yes, it's really risky. You can get killed, but it's pretty rare. And there's usually only one or two things in sport climbing that'll kill you. Your belayer will drop you, you forget to tie your knot, or you take a bad fall in some unpredicted way and have a bad result. Those are the three ways people tend to die sport climbing. And they're all relatively manageable. You can do good partner checks, you can keep an eye on the situation as you climb, you can, you know, there's lots of ways to manage the hazard in that environment. And for that reason, I've never had somebody, a friend of mine, die sport climbing. I have plenty of friends injured, but nobody's died yet, thankfully, and that's great. And then you add complexity in anything, and it gets harder to manage that, and things start to interact in unexpected ways. So you then start going multi-pitch climbing. Now you're managing belay systems higher off the ground. Things are more awkward, and you tend to have more accidents. And then you add trad climbing, where you're relying on protection that you're placing yourself, and that's a lot more variable. And it tends to happen in areas with less clean rock, and that environment gets more complicated. And then again, you tend to have more accidents there. And then you go ice climbing. Ice climbing is again, adds more complexity. There tends to be snow, it tends to be cold. And you add in alpine climbing, and just in a more complex environment, and you have things like rockfall and avalanches, and in each of these stages, you're working in an environment where unforeseen things are more likely to occur, no matter how good you are at it. You know, the very best climbers in the world in terms of alpine and mountaineering, in any sort of 5-year period, about half of them tend to die. And I think that just speaks to how complex that environment is, no matter how good you are in it. And then you add in more altitude, and or, you know, you can swing these variables around in different ways and pick some of the spot. But understanding that complex environments are inherently harder to predict is pretty useful for managing risk. And it applies across not only outdoor sports, but also things like, you know, an industry. If you're doing new things with a team of people, then, yeah, that unknown environment that's more complicated is inherently going to be more hazardous. But that's kind of the big framework for me. Is it simple or is it complex? And then the other half is, what do I know about that environment? Because if you've never been sport climbing and you tie into a rope and start going for it, it may not work out so hot. And so how much do you know? And then how much are you really willing to admit that you know or don't know, and be humble about that? And how good are you? And all those things start to come into play. And do you really want to be dangerous? Or are you being dangerous just because, hey, it's a good day to be dangerous? You know, I do a lot of dangerous things. I'm not arguing against doing dangerous things, but just picking those times and understanding when you do want to be dangerous, and making sure that you're operating where you want to be operating. Most of the time, I like to be operating in that, you know, nice, safe zone, but even there, things can go wrong.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you used to base jump, right? Like the flying wingsuit type of stuff. When we talk about evaluating risk, was there a reason why you stopped doing that?
Well, the goal was always to wingsuit fly, and I had a bunch of friends who were into it. I thought, man, that looks like just the coolest thing ever, and I gotta do that, right? How cool does that look? I fly paragliders a lot, so once the canopy's out, a parachute is in a lot of ways a relatively low performance paraglider until you get into the really small sizes, but your basic sort of base rig or something is just, from a paragliding perspective, pretty straightforward. And then I used to dive in way back in the day, so I'm pretty comfortable in the air, and I was like, I'll just learn how to do this, and then I'll go wingsuit jumping, and this will be rad. And I totally failed to understand how complex and time consuming and just how it's really cool too, but it's a complicated sport, and I didn't approach it that way, and I rapidly figured out that it was really, really, really complicated, and to keep doing it for a long time, in my case, was probably unlikely. My enthusiasm was going to overcome my ability pretty quick, and it was not going to work out for me. It's just the way my brain works. I like to do things, and the people who are really good at base jumping are very, very meticulous. Or the ones who tend to live for a long time tend to be relatively meticulous and pretty laid back. And I am neither of those things. So I just realized that I was going to get killed at it pretty quickly. And best of luck to the people who are doing it. And again, I'm not judging anyone's choice who's into it. But for me, I just realized that was not going to work out. And a good part of risk management is knowing your own head well enough to say, right, this is a good idea or this is a bad idea. And for me, jumping was a bad idea.
But you had done it a couple or a few times, right?
Oh, yeah. I went and jumped out of a plane a bunch. I mean, I went at it. I try to develop competency in anything I do. That's really important to me. So I went and jumped out of a plane a bunch, and then hooked up with my friend Miles D at the bridge at Idaho and started hucking myself off of that. And I went at it with intent and determination to understand it and get good at it. But it's just also very, very fast. And you don't have a lot of time to correct errors. And I make a lot of errors, so I like to have a little bit of time to correct them. It's in any given day of guiding or climbing or whatever, I always look back every day when I get home, and I'm like, all right, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? What can I maybe do different? Or what did I fail to recognize? And every single day I do that. It's guaranteed there's a handful of errors in there that I know of, and probably more that I don't know of. And right. He's jumping. It was like, oh, wow, you know.
Yeah.
Very little time to fix those errors, and you know, you get more time as you get better at it, and your helmet fire shuts down a bit, and you start seeing with more clarity in any high speed activity, whether it's riding a motorcycle or base jumping. You get better at slowing time down and working with it, but you don't have that much time in base jumping before the ground becomes the limit pretty fast.
Right. Yeah.
And it's an awesome thing to do. I just, for me, I didn't think it was going to be what I could do as long term as I want to do it.
But you do continue to paraglide. I mean, like, you actually paraglided the Rockies, right? Like, how did you go about doing that?
I did a really fun trip flying down about half the length of the Canadian Rockies, and that was a great trip. And last summer, I flew my paraglider over the Rockies from Golden, a flight I've always wanted to do, kind of to the eastern slopes, just like the Front Range in Colorado or wherever you are in the Rockies, but straight over the Rockies and in a new way that I'd really wanted to do, very remote, and yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, that's and paragliding, I've never done that before, but obviously that's much less risky than any sort of flying wingsuit type of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different, one of the tricky things in measuring like hazard or outcomes is to compare apples to apples, and it's pretty tricky to do that. You know, your average wingsuit flight doesn't last all that long, whereas your average big paragliding flight may last, you know, hours and hours. So the insurance people just look at it as, do you participate in this regularly? And if so, what are your chances of dying in any year? And that's one way to look at it. I think for me, paragliding is about the same as riding a motorcycle. That's the rough, probably sort of hazard involved in it to me. And, you know, I don't ride my motorcycle. I've sold my motorcycles. I don't ride my motorcycles in the street anymore. I had too many close calls where I felt like that was, and I did not enjoy that anymore. So I love riding motorcycles. They're awesome. But for me, that isn't quite where I want to be. But paragliding feels roughly the same level of hazard, but it's got some other things about it that I really like. So yeah, but again, it's like we're all idiots and crazy to the general public, and
right,
we tend to very narrow differences and go, well, I would do this, but I would never do that. That person's crazy, you know. I would never do A, B, C, or whatever. But
right,
all of our activities are relatively close together, or closer together than we'd like to admit, compared to not doing risk sports at all. So I make judgments for me, and I make judgments when I'm guiding for other people, but I hope people all survive to the degree they want to survive and have an awesome set out every day they go out. But I'm not judging other people that want to do that at all.
Yeah. What about something like you did with Niagara Falls, where you climbed it when it was frozen, first person to climb it? That's normally not allowed, right?
Yeah, very much not allowed. And the exact words were, if you ever try to do this again without a permit, you will go to jail.
Oof.
So it was really, but it took me a couple of years of working on that and listening to the people involved and understanding what their concerns were and really genuinely meeting those concerns, not just paying lip service to the idea. And then also, you know, the cool thing about that was getting people to also look at the upside of risk. And everybody looks at the downside, like, don't do that, it's risky. You know, you hear that all the time, but nothing great in life ever happens without risk. You got to take risks. You don't get a date, you don't get to have kids, you don't get to do all the rad stuff in life without risk. And with Niagara Falls, it was also the upside. And there, you know, what would happen if I did this successfully? And a couple of years after the climb, I ended up getting the keys to the city because bookings were way up. People knew that Niagara Falls was really beautiful.
Sure.
And that's the upside of it. So listening to people and actually understanding how they look at things and meeting their concerns, and then also working with them to figure out what the upside is, you know, that was important. And it was an awesome climb. One of the coolest things I've done in my life.
Speaking of the upside, you were named recently like the UN Environment Mountain Hero, and you've started sort of like teaming up with scientists to help them explore glaciers. Like, you went to the Greenland ice sheet recently. How did you get involved with that, and what is that part of your life like?
Well, it started out like anything great in my life, or anything good I have in my life, is just curiosity. Like with glaciers, it was what's down those holes where all the water goes in the summer. Like, could you go in there in the winter, and what would that look like? And I've done a lot of caving in my life. I really like caving, and it's such pure exploration because there is no map, there's no Google shot. You go into a hole in the ground, and it is totally unknown, and I really love that. And so looking into these holes, I was always up on the glaciers in summer, or maybe doing a bit of ice climbing around the edges of these things. And as a caver, I was like, well, maybe you could go back in there in winter. And that's how it started. We just went down this hole for grins in winter. And it was so cool and so interesting. And then I started contacting a couple of scientists at the University of Alberta. And I was like, so how do these things work? And trying to understand the kind of structure of them. And then they ended up coming out and going down the hole with me and kind of rewriting some of the thoughts they had about how these things are called moulins, where the water goes down into the glacier, how those systems work and why. And then we noticed, one of them noticed this stuff on the wall. And I thought somebody had peed on the wall. It was like this gross yellow stuff. And they're like, oh no, that's a biofilm. And you think about something that can live inside a glacier. And there's not much of this stuff, or not much known about this stuff. So then we ended up going back and sampling it. And it grew from there. And working with a guy named Jason Gully in Greenland, this guy's awesome. He's tried to figure out how the surface meltwater gets to the base of the glacier and then lubricates that, and how fast the glacier then moves toward the sea, and how much that's going to push sea levels up. So interesting guy, Ed. We put together an expedition to actually go down into one of these things, and I got it funded in a different way. He couldn't get his research funded through the standard channels because they thought it was too dangerous. And so got it funded through a couple other ways, and we wound up going down into one of these huge moulins. These things are just massive. Yeah. You know, we're talking like you could hold a huge party, you know, or race. One of these things, a few hundred people would fit down there. And that surprised everybody because they're supposed to be relatively small shafts that go straight to the bed surface. And this one went down about 250 feet, 80 meters, and then went horizontal, which was another surprise because they were supposed to go straight to the bed surface. And Jason had some issues with losing cables that he was trying to put down into these things. And he couldn't understand why that was happening. And that was happening because the shafts didn't go straight to the bed surface like the models predicted, this was a much larger cave than was predicted also. So on that trip, we were able to add quite a lot to how the scientists are looking at moulins. And because of our trip, he was able to get funding through standard channels to go back and do some more research. So he did that this fall. And yeah, it's just really exciting to use some of the skills I've got to help people out. And this isn't guiding, right? I'm never going to run a guiding trip to moulins. Right. This place is hairball. It is not a good idea to go in there, but it is a form of exploration. And if I could help use some of my skills as an athlete and other parts of my life, then it's been just really rewarding to see that a tiny bit of knowledge added through my sports is pretty cool.
No, I mean, I think that's amazing. Have you seen over the course of your life, I guess, as an ice climber, changes in the ice that you're climbing, or glaciers, or have you seen like the effects of climate change? Have you seen enough time to elapse to actually like notice, like, oh my God, there's way less ice here?
I think the first time I understood that things were different, I thought it was a mapping error. You know, I was about, I don't know, 10, 12 years old, and I was on a ski tour. And we were supposed to find this glacier and ski up this glacier, and then that was going to be our access path over these really steep lateral, you know, moraines and systems. And I could not make the map, like, make sense. It just didn't make sense. And the reason was the glacier wasn't there anymore. And I thought that was a mapping error. Obviously, they just looked at it in winter or something and thought it was a glacier, or I don't know, they just screwed up somehow. But all of the maps in the Canadian Rockies are wrong by huge amounts. We're talking like, you know, 10 kilometers, 6 miles of things that are just really different. And then I started to notice, even in my lifetime, that the glaciers were in radically different positions, from the Athabasca to the North Saskatchewan to so many of the glaciers that I've been going to since I was a kid, that they're changing really quickly. And there's kind of a pace of change in nature that you kind of develop an eye for. It's like, okay, a tree is going to grow up in an avalanche path and then it's going to get taken out. And that's why all the trees are small there. It just kind of makes sense. And this glacial thing doesn't make sense. It's happening so fast. And so I started digging into it more and trying to understand it more. And yeah, I'm definitely seeing a huge amount of climate change. At this point, there's really no other rational explanation for it. You know, it's happening so fast. And then I've been fortunate enough to work with some of the top atmospheric scientists and glaciologists in the world. You know, these are not radicals. They think of like spreadsheets and stuff added, like 0.001 of this, you know. They're very, very, they're honestly kind of boring, and they don't get wound up, and they are wound up and really concerned for a good reason. And so I think at this point, I don't want to have to answer the question from my kids in 10 years of like, so Dad, you know, what did you do about climate change? I do want to have at least made some kind of effort to have an impact on the outcome of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great message to put out there. I don't mean to sound morbid when I ask this, but I think given your line of work, it might be an appropriate question. You're over 50 now. Did you expect to make it this far?
I don't think I in some ways, I didn't think I would make it this far. Yeah. Yeah, I've always been pretty realistic about these sports. On the other hand, every time I've got out the door, I've gone out the door with the idea of coming back and tried to keep that goal top in my head. And I think that's something that we need to do as outdoor sports people or anybody that's involved in high risk activities. It's like, what is the goal here? And when I find myself making decisions about pushing for the summit or doing the climb, even though the conditions aren't right, and I forget that my first goal is to come back that day, then I get into trouble. So yeah, I'm surprised to be this old, but I do think I've developed some decent tools and scaled some of the super complex activities that I used to do back a lot. And kids had an impact on that too. You know, I want to be around for my kids and so scale things back and develop good tools. And then go out the door every day with the knowledge that we're going into a really high-risk environment. It's much more hazardous out there in the mountains, climbing and skiing and paddling and flying, than it is driving on the highway or whatever. Those are high-risk activities, but they're much, where we're going is statistically a very high-risk place. And to think that you can always defeat that is to approach it with the wrong mindset. Go out the door with the understanding that it's really dangerous out there. And if we do everything right and really work hard, we may be able to come back in one piece, but it's not a guaranteed thing. And I think that mindset is really critical in high risk environments.
But do you ever feel like, as someone who's doing these risk-taking activities, and I imagine there's gotta be a big rush associated with that, is it ever hard to adjust to the rhythms of just regular day-to-day life?
Yeah, I mean, day-to-day life is really complicated. You got to like deal with people and structures. You get out in the mountains, it's pretty black and white. Did you make the right decision? Well, did you read this right or not? And it's a very complex environment, but the feedback's pretty direct and relatively straightforward. So you get a lot of dissonance between those two worlds. But I find when I'm in the sort of normal quote world for a long time, I am not normal, and eventually there's a problem there, and I've got to go and do I've got to do something that fires me up or works in a different way, and that's where these sports come in, and then when I'm in that world where I'm out there skiing, climbing, paddling, flying a lot, at some point I just had enough of it. And I mean, I always do something physical, go for a run or hike or whatever every day, but I don't want to operate in that high stimulus environment a lot. It burns me out. You know, I just don't enjoy that. At a certain point, I got to do something that feels like I've been creative or made something or you know, mm-hmm. done something that has a little bit different meaning.
What about, like, how do you experience fear in your everyday life? The reason I ask, because I remember, I don't know if you saw the Free Solo movie about Alex Honnold, but they did like a brain scan during that, and it showed that his brain just did not register fear in the same way that normal people do. Not in like a psychopathic way, but, you know, he just was not, it had a much higher fear threshold. Does that resonate with you at all? Do you feel that way?
I always wanted to be that way. When I was younger in particular, I'd be like, wow, so other people are so much more, so much braver and so much stronger and so much smarter and don't feel these, you know, feelings of fear and, you know, lack of ability in the same way that I do. And I really admired that. So, I feel a lot of fear, and I think that's the reason I'm still alive. And it's really important to me to listen to that and recognize when I'm not operating in a good environment. You know, I used to throw up in eddies before I paddled huge drops when I was younger. And that was not a good state to be functioning in. And you don't function well when you're gripped by fear. So it's a warning tool, and it's like, hey, maybe, you know, you've got this desire to do this, but your competency isn't yet there, or maybe you haven't thought about things, and let's slow this down. Let's step back, figure out what's going on and why, and then make a decision about whether to continue or not. And a lot of the guys that I've worked with over the years in a lot of different sports and environments, the ones that do have a healthy level of fear and are like, wow, this, you know, this seems really dangerous, a lot of them are still around. And the guys that are like, hold my beer, not so much. And So for me, fear is not a negative emotion at all. It's like my body or my brain or however you want to look at that whole interaction going, hang on a minute here, you know, have you thought about this? Right. And so I try to listen to that and answer the question and then just balance my confidence, my stoke, my desire with my actual competence and understanding, you know. And YouTube's full of people that are like, got a camera, watch this. They've got very, very high competence or very, very high confidence. You know, they're really sure they can do this, and then very low actual competence. And then they get bit off and make the fail real. So yeah, I like fear a lot. And I think figuring out what is driving your fear and understanding it, and then making decisions, whether it's a, you know, business decision or a, whatever you're dealing with in your life. And that's real strength. And that's, to me, what I strive for. Just hucking my carcass and getting an adrenaline buzz is pretty low on my list of cool things to do. It's like, it's not that interesting. Like, interesting is doing cool stuff that's complicated really well. Like, that's interesting to me. Just the adrenaline buzz, not so much. You know, you could play Russian roulette or,
right,
not that cool.
Yeah, that's an interesting take, because I mean, there are plenty of risky activities that are just not fun at all. You know, but the last question I wanted to ask you, you're doing all these high risk athletic feats, like paragliding, kayaking, ice climbing. There are a lot of people, I guess in like the US, the majority, who are content to have a regular job, like, you know, go to work, come home, and you know, that's their life. On a psychological or spiritual level, whatever you want to call it, why do you find these adventures to be so important for your life?
Well, I have a lot of answers to that question, and first of all, I really appreciate anybody that is living the life that they want to live. Like, to me, that is probably the most important thing that anyone can do. And we're born into such radically different situations. You know, those of us who are kind of born into North America start with a pretty solid leg up. And yeah, and some people are born into really, really tough situations, even here in North America. But trying to make the best life you can out of what you have, and doing that is like, that's what it's all about to me. And so what I do is a little bit different, and I'm trying to do the same thing, which is like, what's cool in life and what's important to me and how do I want to make it work? And I really admire anybody that digs into that and figures it out, you know, if you're, and I also think it's, there's a temptation among outdoor sports people that we're a little bit elitist. It's like, this is the only thing that matters, or because it matters so much to us. We're like, how can anybody even exist without this, like, ski powder? Like, your life is meaningless. Yeah. I think that's a little bit, I don't know, it's a little bit elitist to me. It's like, the more I travel the world, I'm always hanging out in different environments. Through the speaking I do, or some of the corporate stuff work I do, or whatever. It's like, everybody's got something cool going on. Maybe it's like their kids are doing something cool. Maybe it's a car they're restoring in the garage. Maybe it's, they do this thing where they go to Africa for their church, whatever. I've met very few people that don't have something in them that's like firing them up. And I think we have to respect that a little bit more than we sometimes do as outdoor sports people. It's like, the world's awesome, man, you know, and people are doing cool stuff. It's just, we're a little bit weird. We need, for whatever reason, a little more risk or higher consequence, depending on how you look at it. And for people like us, it's probably a lot healthier to do these outdoor sports than some of the other higher risk activities out there that we could be doing. So everybody, each to their own, and just a little respect for everybody striving to make life whatever they can.
Absolutely. On that note, Will Gadd, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you to Will Gadd, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.